ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Hello, and welcome to episode 221 of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. We're here today with Dr. Robert Pearl, the Executive Director and CEO of the Permanente Medical Group. He's also the President and CEO of the Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group and co-CEO of the Permanente Federation. He's a contributor to Forbes magazine, the chairman of the Council of Accountable Physician Practices, a professor at Stanford School of Business, the author of Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong, and all profits for this book are going to charity to increase access for healthcare for those who cannot obtain healthcare today. Dr. Pearl is a former physician-in-chief at the Permanente Medical Group, a former residency director of plastic and reconstructive surgery at Stanford Hospital, former assistant physician-in-chief at the Permanente Medical Group, and a board-certified plastic and reconstructive surgeon. You can learn more about Robert at Twitter, at RobertPearlMD is his handle. So, Dr. Pearl, thank you so much for joining us today. How are you doing?
Very well, Jordan.
Excellent. So the first question I'd like to pose to you is, what are you currently doing or what have you ever done to advance the public interest and why?
So my entire career has been focused on advancing the public interest, particularly to save the lives of hundreds of thousands of individuals. My career began first practicing medicine, where I was able to provide care, particularly to children with birth defects, patients with cancer. As I advanced in Kaiser Permanente in taking on a more administrative type roles, I was able to help lead Kaiser Permanente to being the number one healthcare organization in this country based upon the National Committee for Quality Assurance assessment of almost 1,000 programs, with Kaiser Permanente being the only one to receive a 5-star rating for both commercial and Medicare. And if every American received the same care we provide today, 30% of heart deaths would be avoided, a significant number of cancer deaths would be avoided, and my current plan and why I wrote Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and We're Usually Wrong, is now to take this to the national level. My goal is to transform American medicine. American medicine today most closely resembles a 19th century cottage industry. It's fragmented with doctors scattered across the community. It's hospitals, small hospitals in every town. It's paid on a piecemeal basis. We call it fee-for-service, but it's really piecemeal medicine. The more you do, the more you get paid, whether the results get better or not. The technology across most of this nation is left over from the last century. Patients can't get the convenience that they have and demand in travel, banking, retail. They never would bank someplace where they couldn't access their information 24/7. The majority of Americans have to call the doctor's office or go there Monday to Friday, 9 to 5. They would never fly an airplane if they couldn't book their reservation online. They have to call the doctor's office again and wait on hold while it's open in order to schedule an appointment with a physician. They can't send a secure email. They can't do a video visit. We need to change all of that, and I wrote Mistreated, in order to help transform American medicine. Right now in the United States today, 500,000 people die unnecessarily each year, including my father, who was the focus of the book and to whom I dedicated. They die from omissions in prevention. They die from medical errors. They die from having complications from chronic disease that could have been prevented. The reason it's not is that the system, the context is broken, and my goal in this next phase of my life is actually to move from Kaiser Permanente into the entire nation to try to transform American medicine for the better. We are the most expensive country in the world, 50% more expensive than the next most expensive nation, and yet our quality outcomes are in the lower half of the industrialized world. We're last in childhood mortality, life expectancy. A girl born in Seoul, Korea today will live to an average age of 90. In the United States, that same girl is 7 years fewer. The American populace is mistreated. As I point out in the book, we don't even recognize and understand why that is.
Now, Kaiser Permanente does offer many of those things that are not available to Americans. You made an analogy to the banking industry and having appointments and being able, of course, with Kaiser, you have telemedicine on your phone, 24/7 available access to physicians. But of course, Kaiser Permanente currently is available in Hawaii and California, Oregon, Washington, Maryland, Virginia, D.C., Colorado, and Georgia. So only a few of the whole states. You've mentioned your goal of making Kaiser Permanente available for all Americans, and if that were to be the case, we'd see improvements in healthcare quality, reductions in cost, better well care, preventive medicine, a reduction of 30% of all heart deaths if everyone was a member of Kaiser Permanente. And of course, you guys have been setting the trend. Kaiser Permanente is ahead of the curve with creating HMOs that improve population health over time, and you see that reflected to some extent in the current transition from CMS from fee-for-service to bundled payments. The question I'd like to pose to you, Dr. Pearl, is if Kaiser Permanente is so great and adding so much value and is really helping Americans who are members of Kaiser Permanente, and if the federal legislation to some extent has been following and federal regulations have been following current practices of Kaiser, what exactly is preventing Kaiser from being extended to all Americans across all markets?
The biggest challenge in moving from this 19th century cottage industry that is fragmented and paid on this piecemeal basis with technology from the last century to a more advanced organization structure like Kaiser Permanente. As you said, I'm the chairman of CAP. That's 28 of the nation's largest and most integrated medical groups. It's not just Kaiser Permanente. It's Mayo Clinic. It's the Mountain Health. It's Geisinger. All of those organizations are able to accomplish the same types of outstanding outcomes. But accomplishing that, making it happen, is difficult. You've got to bring physicians together and integrate them both horizontally within departments and vertically between primary care and specialty care. Doctors often like to be independent. You got to change the way you pay them, paying them not on volume, but paying them on outcomes. And that requires a restructuring and redistribution of income, and that's always very controversial. And you've got to help to create a single integrated comprehensive electronic health record. Today, that simply doesn't exist. Each doctor has their own office system in most of the communities across this country, if they have one at all. And bringing that together and creating a common API approach that third-party developers could build off of, these are massive, massive changes. But I wrote Mistreated because I do believe that when the patient in all of us understands and recognizes all that they are missing, that they will begin to demand it. And when they begin to demand it, that their companies, the businesses of this nation, will start to demand it. And I'm hoping that at some point, what we will see is that businesses will say 5 years from now, we're not going to buy coverage for our employees unless it is integrated, unless it is paid on a pay-for-value, a capitated basis, unless the most modern technology is in place. You know, the book is very much about how context shifts perception and impacts behavior. I look at both the behavioral psychological research from the past, much of which could not be done today due to ethical concerns on the impact of the psychological implications for the participants, and the most modern brain scanning technique. In the book itself, I talk about the Stanford Prison Experiment. We all studied it in college. Zimbardo takes normal students, half the finds his jailers, he gives them aviator sunglasses. Half of them are jailees, they get OR greens with a number instead of a name on it. Within 48 hours, the jailers see, and I want to say the word see, it's about perception, the jailees as being dangerous, as being criminals. They inflict these basing punishments on them. And at the same time, the jailees see the jailers as being sadistic, as prison guards, they board up the doors. Everyone knows the other people are just simply students. but that's not the way they see them. Context shifts perception, changes behavior. Another good example was Joshua Bell, the virtuoso violinist. Plays Saturday night in Boston Symphony. Monday morning goes in the Metro in Washington, D.C. Old clothes and a baseball cap. Plays the same Stradivarius violin, the same type of music. Makes $34 in 43 minutes. 99% is not auditory, it's context. And that is the problem. Ask most Americans about the medical care we provide in this country. They're likely to say it's the best in the world, even if it's too expensive. Look at the objective data on life expectancy. Look on the number of people who get the best outcomes across this country. We control hypertension only 55% of the time across the United States. Those cap groups, 90%. Colon control, colon cancer prevention. Half of the deaths in the United States from colon cancer could be avoided, but we're only screening 50 or 60% of the time. Again, the leading groups do the appropriate screening 90% of the time. We can change things, but it's this difference between perception and reality that drove me to research and write Mistreated, because I think the hardest part of the change you're asking about, Jordan, is the fact that people can't see it. Physicians like being paid on this fee-for-service basis. They're not going to want to spend the money on investing in the new computer systems unless they have to. And their perception of what needs to happen, therefore, changes, and patients end up being mistreated. But it's more than that, Jordan. One of the other reasons I wrote the book, besides my father's premature and unnecessary death, as well as wanting to change the American healthcare system, is the American profession of medicine. Because what we see today is that doctors are actually suffering. A third of physicians report being depressed. Half of physicians say they would not tell their children to become physicians. And there are over 400 suicides a year. The system change that I'm describing is not going to make the lives of people worse. It's going to make them only better. Whether it's going to be a patient or whether it's going to be a physician. But until we change the structure, the reimbursement, and the technology in this nation, what we're going to see is that the cost of healthcare will continue to rise more rapidly than our ability to pay. Quality will go down. We'll end up either in a two-tier system where not just the poor get different care than everyone else, but that the middle class, those on Medicare, and find themselves increasingly not able to get the care that the rich can buy independently, or as I talk about in the book, it's possible that the American healthcare system will simply get disrupted, not by an American technology company, as some have talked about, but actually by an offshore company, by people other parts of the world. And the book, I talk about Debbie Shetty. And I talk about Debbie Shetty. Debbie Shetty is a heart surgeon trained in the United States. Who runs 11 heart hospitals in India. Where if you ask Debbie Shetty, who, by the way, was Mother Teresa's physician, so a pretty prominent individual, what does he do? He says, I set the price of a human life. And when you say, Debbie, what do you mean you set the price of a human life? We'll say every morning outside my office, there are 30 moms with 30 babies in their arms. Every baby needs surgery. I talk with them for a few minutes. They've all been well worked up. And I tell them that the surgery will be $1,800. That's what he charges for surgery, $1,800. But in India, only about 10% of people have insurance. So the two options that they can borrow the money and have the surgery.
And just for context, Dr. Pearl, what would a similar type surgery potentially cost in the United States? So Americans have a sense, a comparative sense of what that $1,800 looks like.
Somewhere between $60,000 and $150,000, depending upon what hospital you go to.
To say it's an enormous discount that he's offering would be an understatement, correct?
Oh, it's far, far, far less. But for reasons I'll explain in a second, some of that is simply the wage differential. But a lot of it is the way he structures the care, the large volume that he provides. When I was there visiting him at Thanksgiving, the day I was there, his team did 37 heart surgeries, including a heart transplant. That's
in one
more
day.
Than almost in one day. That's more than almost any university in the United States does in a month. His ability to achieve outcomes that rival the best in the United States at a cost, as you say, it's $1,800 compared to $60,000 to $150,000 is remarkable. At least half of the difference is the way that he provides the care through teams, through specialization, through looking at every way to achieve operational efficiency. But what I was saying is that he talks about how if you can lower the cost from $1,800 to $1,500, more children will live and he will have elevated the value. What's most interesting to me is not India, because I don't think Americans are going to India. We just opened a hospital in the Cayman Islands. The Cayman Islands are a one-hour plane flight from Florida. I don't know if you've ever been to Jordan. It's beautiful. 7 Mile white sand beach, the tourist economy, great weather, everything totally safe. He's building a 2,000-bed hospital in the Cayman Islands for a country with a population of 50,000. 20 of those beds will be for the Cayman Island people. The rest, I'm sure he's aiming to people from the United States. There he's not doing it for $1,800, but he is doing it for about half the cost, for about $30,000 rather than $60,000 to $150,000. And as I say, the outcomes he's getting are world class. It's possible American medicine will find itself to be evolving into a two-tier system. It's possible we'll be disrupted by the Debbie Sheddies of the world. My hope, and why I wrote in the street, is because I do believe that if we can change the structure, change the context, change the reimbursement, change the technology of medicine, physicians are very motivated. Once they're in the right context, the care they provide will start to become significantly better in quality, significantly more convenient. They will embrace modern technology, and the cost will drop significantly.
So, Dr. Pearl, so much of – you covered a lot of ground just now. And of course, according to the Institute of Medicine's 1999 report, To Err is Human, it really brought quality to the foreground. A lot has happened since that point. So you do have the National Committee for Quality Assurance. You do have different quality metrics. You do have the National Quality Forum. You do have a transition to pay for performance away from fee-for-service. You have an increasing, focus in the American healthcare system on improving quality and reducing iatrogenic errors, which is physician-caused errors or other sorts of medical errors. So a lot of attention has already been paid to quality, and a lot of books have been written on quality. I wonder, what is it uniquely that you're bringing with your new book? And you have mentioned context and the difference between structural changes and cultural changes. So I'd like to ask you to differentiate between the structural changes that you're asking for, right? What your vision is of the future, how you're going to shift to global payments. We covered that already. Certain regulatory and, structural changes. And you spoke about consumer-driven cultural changes. You mentioned the study to replicate, to explain the Holocaust, essentially, in the Stanford psychological experiment. And then you mentioned Joshua Bell as being an example of Americans not appreciating the intrinsic value of something, but more the contextual value of something. I guess if you could differentiate or elaborate upon what it is that you're hoping American consumers would do, because you do have the Leapfrog group that's ranking hospitals. You do have the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services ranking healthcare systems, payers, and all sorts of different other healthcare providers. So I guess, what is your vision for American healthcare, where you do have a very consumer-driven cultural shift where they appreciate real value and no longer call a system that's overpriced and has a lesser degree of quality than we desire the best in the world, although perhaps we have the best technology and the best research and the best care if you're wealthy, and the best acute care, but not for chronic disease. So I guess, would you please elaborate on what your vision is for the future of American medicine? What sort of changes need to take place? And if you were in charge of everything, how would the world look?
So you're absolutely right that the problem is well known. The problem has been written about by policy experts. They can study in textbooks. You talked about the Institute of Medicine's groundbreaking presentation of the nearly 200,000 deaths every year from medical error. Johns Hopkins just published a new survey about 6 months ago. The number hasn't changed. We've not been successful at lowering the total number of people who die unnecessarily, like my father, from medical error, at least based upon the Johns Hopkins data. What we know is that we would never tolerate the inconveniences of American medicine in our travel and our banking, and yet we keep tolerating it in healthcare today. I talk in the book about President Clinton. After he left office, his wife was the senator from New York. They lived in New York. And the state of New York publishes a very well risk-adjusted analysis of the cardiovascular programs in the 35 hospitals in the greater New York area. When he developed a heart problem, the heart center he went to for the diagnostic evaluation was the second worst of the 35. And then when he needed surgery, he went to the worst in all of New York City. And, of course, he suffered a complication. And what was amazing to me about the story wasn't that he did that the first time, because maybe he didn't know better. I would think he would. I mean, he was certainly a leader in healthcare reform legislation, and he certainly has available to him lots of different advisors. But 6 years later, when he needed surgery again on the complication, where did he go back to? The same hospital that was at the bottom of the entire list of 35. So mistreated focuses on two areas that you're asking. One is the patient, and one is the system. I think for the patient, what I want to do is have people, individuals, recognize that the care they're getting that they think is so good probably isn't, that they probably are risking mistreatment. It may not have happened yet, but they're risking mistreatment from a medical error or an error in avoiding treating a chronic illness and getting a complication, or errors in missing opportunities around prevention. I want to open the eyes of patients. And that's why I talk about, I wrote the book for the patient in all of us, and why I'm donating so much of all the profits to charity. But the second part is actually changing the system itself. And as I talk about in the book, the legacy players are not likely to push the change. They're doing okay today. The doctors, they say, are having a significant amount of personal problems. They are as much the victim of this as the patients. But insurance companies are doing well. Drug companies are doing exceptionally well. Many of the hospital systems are doing well. They're not going to make the changes that are necessary in structure, reimbursement, and technology, because that is the foundation of the context that shifts behavior, perception of behavior. Let's look at it. If you're integrated, we work together, all the doctors in a particular specialty in a community, suddenly they're not competitors. Suddenly they're on the same team. And when you're on the same team, collaboration, cooperation increase, and patients are less likely to fall through the cracks. When you pay people, not, you know, the phrase that's being used is pay for value, but that can have lots of different meanings. But when you actually capitate a group of physicians and hospitals taking care of a population of patients, suddenly prevention becomes as important as intervention. Suddenly, avoiding medical error becomes crucial. Suddenly, making sure patients with chronic illness don't get another disease. You don't control hypertension 55%, you control it 90%. You don't screen for colon cancer half of the time. You do it 90% of the time. You don't, as I talk about in the book, delay intervention around sepsis, systemic infection. You actually put in place processes so that every patient is appropriately evaluated. I'll give you another really good example of Kaiser Permanente. So we have a stroke-trained neurologist available on video seeing every patient that comes into any of our 20 emergency rooms in Northern California the minute they arrive. The difference is that in the typical hospital in the United States, the time that it takes, the so-called door-to-needle time, between a patient coming in with a stroke and getting the very powerful clot-busting drugs is over an hour. We've lowered that under 30 minutes. saving lives, saving brain function. That can't happen without the context. Unless the physicians work together, there's no way a neurologist can just be on video seeing patients coming into the ED in 20 different locations. Depending on our intervention, there's no way that they're going to put the same emphasis on being able to evaluate patients and make the decisions as going in and pulling out the clot that might have formed or opening up the blood vessels with a stent that might be necessary. And if you don't have a comprehensive electronic health record, you not only don't have the information or the access through video to every emergency department, but equally importantly, you don't have the patient's comprehensive and full medical information. It's all of those pieces. And why I wrote Mistreated is I don't believe we're actually going to solve these problems you described. Even though the information's out there, we're not going to make the changes until we restructure that context. And what's the good part to me, and part of why I talk about the Stanford Prison Experiment or why Milgram's study where two-thirds of people will inflict a lethal electric shock onto someone else in the wrong context, is that if people will do bad things as a result of context, why not good things? Once you change the context of American medicine from the last millennium to the current time, once it is restructured and physicians work together as one, once it is changed with how they're paid so that we reward prevention and avoidance as much as intervention, and once that comprehensive, and I want to use that phrase, comprehensive electronic record is available, so we have all the information and it's presented to us, suddenly behavior will change. I'll add one last piece, and I've written about this because I think it's important that physicians lead this process. They're the most trusted individuals in healthcare today. They're the ones who are making many of the decisions, and we need better physician leadership. Physicians will not follow a hospital administrator or insurance company CEO. They just don't trust them. But they will follow a colleague whom they know and whom they have respect for. And so that combination of changing the structure, moving from fragmentation to integration, changing reimbursement from fee-for-service to capitation, changing technology from the last century to the modern century with comprehensive EHR and with video and secure email and digital and creating physician leadership, those are the four pillars that, to me, define the roadmap for the future.
So, Dr. Pearl, we are approaching the end of this podcast episode, and as such, I'd like to ask you a final question. I'd like for you to reflect to an audience of patients about why it is that you're clearly very impassioned about changing this healthcare system to improve it for others, though clearly you're in a position where you are already able to discern what is high-quality care for yourself and you're already receiving it. So it seems as though your motivation is really to make the world better for others, which is the theme of this podcast. You have alluded to previous of motivation, such as the death of your father due to partially preventable reasons. Could you elaborate for our listeners, for patients, about why it is you're so motivated to advance the public interest for patients around the country, and then what you hope your legacy will be? I know you've mentioned a lot about context, and maybe you can just elaborate on what exactly this context looks like. What do you hope the American patient will take away from your book, Mistreated, and what do you hope will be the result of their insights that you offer into American medicine?
So my entire career, I've wanted to make the lives of patients better. I don't know how we know exactly why we choose different paths in life, but that's why I went into medicine. I became a plastic reconstructive surgeon because I wanted to fix children with cleft lips and cleft palates and spent a lot of time in other parts of the world doing it on a volunteer basis. I'm at Kaiser Permanente. That has a long history of being mission-driven and putting the patient first and making certain that the quality of care that's provided is done in the way that is best for patients and convenient and is most affordable. So I've throughout my career, I've been attracted to every opportunity that I could find. to make American medicine better. But I ultimately wrote the book because of the death of my father. He was a remarkable man, and he died unnecessarily, and he didn't die because of bad physicians. I was not castigating the doctors or bad hospitals. He died because of a bad system. And I talk at the end about the last days when he developed he didn't actually die during the first infection that he experienced, but he died from complications thereof. He got a bleed into his brain. The hospital in Florida notified my brother and me. We flew out there. There was a line of doctors out the door. The ENT doctor wanted to do a tracheostomy. The GI doctor wanted to put a feeding tube. The neurosurgeon wanted to take out pieces of his bone from the brain, his skull, to allow the brain to expand. And my brother and I recognized my father was never going to recover and have anywhere near a normal life that he would want. And we declined all their offers. And for the next 2.5 days, we never saw a physician. There is no CPT code, the way that doctors bill, for compassion. In a fee-for-service world, you don't get paid for holding the hands of the family members and comforting them in the most difficult times. And so the legacy that I would like to have, and in the end probably why I wrote Mistreated, was simply to save human life. 500,000 people dying every year in the nation's wealthiest country, the one that spends more than any other nation by far on health care. It's just not conscionable. We can do better. And the legacy that I'd like to know is that through the death of my father, that I will have helped save tens and hundreds of thousands of other premature deaths, that I will have saved other families the pain and the suffering that happens from losing a loved one. My hope is that through the book, if I can change American medicine, if I can transform it into one that is integrated and capitated, that uses modern technology and is physician-led, that my father's death will have not been for no avail. Instead, it will have served the purpose to simply improve the health and the lives of the American people.
And that has been Dr. Robert Pearl, Executive Director and CEO of the Permanente Medical Group, Mid-Atlantic Permanente Medical Group, the co-CEO of the Permanente Foundation, contributor to Forbes magazine, chairman of the Council for Accountable Physician Practices, a professor at Stanford, author of Mistreated, Why We Think We're Getting Good Healthcare and Why We're Usually Wrong, a plastic surgeon, a reconstructive surgeon, an individual who has spent many years in medicine, both as a provider and as an administrator, who speaks about a bad healthcare system in America. And it's not the fault of individuals, the fault of a poorly constructed and incentivized healthcare system that is producing expensive and low-quality care. He speaks of seeking to have, he emphasizes the primacy of the dignity of human life. For Dr. Pearl, it's about saving lives and saving families the pain associated with life lost prematurely. He seeks to improve Americans' experiences with healthcare. And more than anything, although it may be counterintuitive, he's interested in having well Americans who don't need healthcare. And that he speaks of an America where that could be profitable, the healthcare system, if they focus on having a capitated, which is often used in American context, which may be familiar to listeners, the per member, per month sort of payment system that allows health insurance companies and hospitals and physicians to assume risk for the care that they provide. Dr. Pearl speaks about both cultural and structural changes, wanting consumer-driven care so that consumers begin to demand that high-quality health care be delivered and that they no longer tolerate errors in health care that they wouldn't tolerate in other areas of the economy. Ultimately, Dr. Pearl seeks to have a fundamental transformation of American healthcare, both from a systemic point of view, but also from an individual healthcare consumer's point of view. And with his words of wisdom, hopefully we'll get a little bit closer to that vision. So Dr. Pearl, I'd like to thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Jordan. It's been a pleasure. And I do hope that the listeners will read the book. I seek their feedback. I believe that if we can align all of the patients and all of us in a conversation and a discussion, we can change American healthcare, and as you said so well, save the lives of hundreds of thousands of Americans every single year.
Thank you, Dr. Pearl.
You're welcome.
This has been another episode of Public Interest Podcast with your host, Jordan Cooper, where we interview politicians, activists, advocates, and others who seek to improve the state of the world. I'll remind you to subscribe on publicinterestpodcast.com and on iTunes. Leave a review of this podcast on iTunes and listen on Stitcher, SoundCloud, CastBox, Blueberry, Player FM, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube. Should you wish to comment on this episode, you're welcome to leave a voicemail at 240-630-0380. And the first 3 minutes of that voicemail may be played in future episodes of Public Interest Podcast. Should you wish to support the podcast, you're welcome to leave a contribution in an amount that you feel comfortable with at publicinterestpodcast.com. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.